All right, welcome back to Ride On. I'm James Gross, and I'm here today with Ed Niedermeyer. Ed is the author of Ludicrous, the unvarnished story of Tesla Motors. He's also the co-host of the Autonocats, which you can find that gets put out weekly, I believe.
Usually, most weeks.
Almost all, every week. And then finally, I'll leave you with a quote from Nathan Robinson, who has suggested that there's probably no greater expert on the career of Elon Musk or the development of Tesla than Niedermeyer. So that's a nice quote from Nathan, and a good reason to have you on today, Ed. So welcome on to Ride On.
Thanks so much for having me.
So today we're going to talk about a big ruling that actually happened out here in California. Ed's up in Oregon, but still probably has a lot of impact on all cities in the United States. And that is the CPUC, California Public Utilities Commission, approving the permits for Cruise and Waymo to charge fares for passenger services in San Francisco. This came down last week as part of a 3-1 pro vote. And there was, to say the least, a lot of controversy and a lot of division over these permits being allowed. So, Ed, maybe I'll just start there. How big of a moment was this vote last week for L4 vehicles and cities? And maybe even if you could explain the L4 concept a little bit more for the audience.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because on the one hand, if you pay close attention to the sort of, steady evolution of AVs and their sort of slow integration into our society, this is not necessarily that big of a moment, right? In terms of what was actually being decided by the CPUC, all they were really doing was allowing them to expand basically paid operations. They don't regulate the safety of these vehicles or anything like that. It's a Public Utilities Commission. And so it was really just regulating them as a mobility service that you can pay for. And that's really what the ruling was just sort of allowing them to be paid for rides sort of without restrictions within San Francisco. So on the policy level, this was not actually like a huge moment per se, but the sort of from a policy perspective, this is pretty minor. From a political perspective, this is actually quite a big moment. And I think you saw that in the hearing, which I certainly did not expect to go for I think it was over 5 hours of public comments. As someone who's been following AVs pretty closely, I spent almost 2 years at Partners for Automated Vehicle Education, which is sort of the AV sector's, sort of public education nonprofit. It was really good. I thought it was a huge moment to see such a big public conversation around this technology. That to me was the really big thing, was that we hadn't had this sort of big public conversation about what this technology is and what it's doing and the future. And I think, it wasn't a great conversation, like a lot of public conversations. There's a lot of confusion about what these things are. And so people kind of have a lot of opinions. So there's a lot of like heat, but not necessarily a lot of light in that conversation. But the fact that we were having it was huge because we just haven't had those big public conversations yet about this technology.
Yeah, I agree. I think I don't want to say must see TV because public comments can always, can definitely be watched at two times speed. But it was like, it had that feeling that, wow, there is a lot of division here and a lot of smart takes on that division. And like, this has not worked out. But at the same time, I like your comment heat there. Like, I think, when there's this much public discourse, it's good to actually go into it like a moth to the flame, in a sense. Like, there's probably something very real here that we need to work out. And so, on our side, sort of representing, micromobility industries and what we do, I personally believe this is a big moment to move to a paid model and to potentially, wrap a business model around these technologies. Where my hope is this could be the type of vehicle regulation in more of an autonomy L4 type style vehicle that could lead to the type of lowering of death rates that you see with other regulation like the seatbelt or the, when we started to enforce the US, which also came with quite a bit of controversy when those were first being regulated both at the state and then the federal level. I'm curious what you think there. Where do you sit, Ed, on is this technology for good and for potentially the reduction of 43,000 Americans we lose every year in and around vehicles? Or is this just, very clever policymaking by very wealthy technology companies that are gonna, take over soon?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and certainly, I think the way you frame that really captures sort of the political conversation, right? Which I think is that AVs are really, in a lot of ways, they're a symbol of this sort of very tense relationship, I think, between the tech sector and the rest of San Francisco and the Bay Area. And I think when I watched and read a lot of these comments, like, that to me was the thing that stood out. You know, it's interesting, when I was at PAVE, we did a survey, a public opinion sort of survey, and to me the most interesting, you know, thing, the lesson that we came out of this was that the people who feared and mistrusted AVs the most, were the people who also self-reported knowing almost nothing about it. And the more people report knowing about it, the more they are willing to trust it. And I think, again, I think that's kind of what you're seeing here, is you're seeing people, you know, these vehicles are showing up. They're very visible on the road. You can't miss them. They've got these bulges sticking out of them. They don't look like other cars on the road. You know, there's this history now of, like, kind of tension and you know, and bad feelings with the tech sector and other people in the Bay Area. And I think that, you know, people latch on to that, and that's what it is. And so when you hear a lot of these comments, there's a lot of emotion. And you know, I think the core problem in a lot of ways is that, you know, there are some, the concerns are valid in that there hasn't been enough transparency, I think, and there hasn't been enough public discourse and public outreach and, frankly, public education. I say this, you know, self-critically, considering I was supposed to be sort of working on that. You know, I think what these conversations, the fear, but that combination of fear, but not really understanding the technology shows, you know, I think this was the industry's problem to solve, and that they kind of haven't done enough about it. I think this is sort of there's a through line with a lot of things in tech, where people like to believe that, well, we just develop this technology and it will just, you know, sort of win everyone over by just how amazing it is. And the reality is that that's not really true. And for something like driving, where it's, you know, you're talking about computers making life and death decisions, people are just going to have fears about it. And people need to sort of understand what is worth being afraid of and nervous about, and what isn't. And just at a very high level, like, to me, as someone who does pay a lot of attention to this stuff, you know, the L4 companies, and yeah, so to answer your previous question, L4, we're talking about vehicles that are fully autonomous. There's no human behind the wheel, you know, unless they're still in development. And they operate within a fixed area. And so, you know, there's one of the misconceptions is that these L4 robotaxi companies like Cruise and Waymo are, like, playing fast and loose and, like, really sort of, like, you know, don't have good safety cultures. And actually, the L4 companies that are doing this kind of robotaxi and autonomous trucking and stuff, it's ironic. The things that make the car stand out, those sensor bubbles, you know, and bulges sticking out, those are actually things that prove that these companies are doing the safe thing. Whereas I think if you're concerned about this technology, you really have to be paying attention to Tesla, because they're actually putting cars out on the road that have, you know, the NTSB has investigated 3 fatalities now involving autopilot and conclusively demonstrated that Tesla's design decisions about how they make that, you know, how they developed that system contributed to people dying. So, you know, on the one hand, I think it's fair and legitimate to have concerns about the L4 stuff that's happening in San Francisco, these robotaxi companies. But I think it's super, super important to put that in context of, we also have a company going around putting experimental technology that really induces, you know, untrained people to overtrust it, and then it crashes into things that's not good enough, and people have been injured and died. Like, to me, the furor around San Francisco was happening there just doesn't seem in proportion to the harms being caused, especially when you put it in the context of what's happening in Tesla, where, again, we're talking about body counts, human beings dying because they trust this technology too much.
Yeah. Okay. So to summarize what you're saying here, I think we've got, like, a bunch of buckets that everything's being lumped into that it'd probably be good for public discourse to start to break it apart. So the first thing you said, I mean, literally, it sounds like your own data that you went out and did. Fascinating, right? Like, the people that are scared of the autonomous L4 vehicles on the road probably just don't know much about them. That's very fair, and we've got to fix that.
Yep.
And that probably is, again, the big part of the bell curve, right? Like, if we figure that out, you probably easily get, you know, mass approval. But there is, let's just talk really briefly about this group of what I would call really smart urbanists. You know, we saw the SF Bike Coalition and SF Bike come out against autonomous vehicles at that hearing. People that I mean, are just smart, trained urbanists who, again, I disagree with. I share the road with them. I'm on a bicycle as well. I feel differently than they do, but I respect their opinion. What do you think that attitude is? And again, my biggest overcome was when I rode in a Waymo in San Francisco, and I actually felt it. And I said, oh my God, like, okay, like I've been in enough cars to know how amazing this is versus an Uber driver or my self-driving. So what is it about that group though? Have they not ridden in the Waymo, or is any car never going to be the solution for them and they're never going to be happy? I'm just curious what you think there, because I think they're smart enough to know enough about the technology to where they should be a little bit further along than I thought they would be in coming out that hard against the L4s.
Yeah, there's a couple of misconceptions I keep seeing from really smart people who I respect a lot and who I think, and again, like I'm not, I think it's totally fair and fine for them to be skeptical of this technology, but like I want to see them, you know, focus on the real issues and not, you know, things that are not really the issue. So like one of the biggest ones of this is the you know the and we saw this like multiple times in the hearings at the public comment hearings, was this fear that like if we pass this approval that they're just gonna like flood the streets with AVs and that like there's just gonna be thousands and thousands and thousands of these vehicles on the fleet. And there's like this gets to the heart of one of the things that I think urbanists should appreciate or hopefully appreciate, and I've certainly tried to and you know I'm continuing to try and get this message out there, which is that, you know, cars are one thing, but AVs really are not cars. It makes much more sense to think of AV like level 4 robotaxis as like robotic mobility infrastructure more than cars. And to just explain this, let's imagine the technology is just perfect, right? Like there's a huge difference if you think about a car as you know it, which you own and just like serves you and your mobility needs. Again, this is what Tesla's selling, is this idea that you can buy a car and it's going to drive itself. If that were true, and we're lucky that what Tesla's selling is not, you know, is in my opinion, a scam. We're lucky because if they could deliver on that and everyone had a private car that could drive itself, like traffic would be terrible. And the exact nightmare that I think urbanists are thinking that this technology is going to lead to would absolutely happen. But luckily, you know, in order to sell that at an affordable price point to private car owners, like the technology just isn't good enough, which is why every year Elon Musk is like, our car's going to drive a car, you know, they're driving themselves at the end of the year and 6-7 years later, they're still not, right? And whereas when you talk about a level 4, like a robotaxi, again, think about all of those sensors and everything that are on it that make it so visible, right? Those are LiDAR sensors. Those are really expensive radar sensors. And you have multiple modalities that are overlapping each other. So you have redundancy and what's called sensor diversity, which allows them to, and like you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars just in the sensors required to keep that safe. When you have a vehicle that's that expensive, someone's not gonna be able to buy it and own it. And especially, you know, you're talking about spending $300,000 on a car that you can't take out of San Francisco. Like no one's gonna buy that car. And so what you have is you have robotaxi fleets. And because each of those vehicles is so expensive, there's a huge fixed cost. And when you have a capital intensive business with huge fixed costs, the only way you make money is by intensively utilizing those assets. In other words, the way to make money with a robotaxi, the only way to make money with a robotaxi fleet is to size the fleet as small as you can to serve the number of rides in that market, right? It's all about efficiency. And so if you actually understand how the technology and the economics of a robotaxi from an urbanist perspective, I can't understand why anyone's arguing against this, because what we're saying is replace, like, yes, there's still cars as a form factor. Like they look like cars and they share infrastructure with cars. And again, if AVs were holding back a tidal wave of bike infrastructure investment in this country, I would say, sure, like let's have these things trade off against each other. But they don't. And in fact, I strongly believe that both the safety approach that L4 companies take, again, there's more that they can do. But I think the relative safety approach against certainly versus a Tesla, which has basically no sensors that can reliably detect pedestrians, especially in like low light conditions, things like that. You know, that's the right approach, and that it's super compatible with maybe not a car free city, but certainly, you know, car free chunks of cities. So, for example, if you want to say like, let's take this however many blocks and make it a completely car free zone. Okay, like you're still going to need to get out to other places, you know, in the suburbs. You have to go to the airport, for example. You have to go to other places, right? That's where I think that actually the urbanist sort of biking and pedestrian first, but then sort of you need something for getting outside of that zone. That AVs, that robotaxis, shared AV fleets are actually as well aligned with that urbanist vision as any other way of handling that, you know? And so it is a frustration. I understand, but like people, again, the people look at the EVs and they see cars, and it's just so important to help people understand that, like, how the ownership and the operational model for L4 robotaxi fleet and for private self-driving vehicles is totally, totally different. And luckily, the technology won't support private ownership right now. We can only do a shared model with the AVs. It's the only way with current technology that we can make a business work. So Urbanist, it should be embracing this moment and trying to make L4 AVs a viable option, because maybe at some point, if they fight it and fight it and fight it, maybe at some point the technology does get good enough, if we haven't used L4 to really make like sort of robotic mobility infrastructure in our cities, that we will get that nightmare scenario that Elon's selling, which is everyone stuck in gridlock because everyone has a self-driving car and no one's actually driving.
Okay, so I think you did two good jobs there. One, I think you, of course, the first bell curve you explained, which is just lack of education. I think we can figure that one out. The second one on the louder vocal minority of urbanists who are, you know, doing what they're doing and trying to block this. I believe your pitch works. Have you tried this to some of these vocal urbanists, and what do they say back to that? Because I think once you parse out the Elon private car ownership, I understand how this is not really the L4 technology from the L4 technology, and why, if it's centralized, clearly can be more regulated as a centralized shared unit. All the positives that we see in, say, shared micromobility and how you can regulate that centrally versus, you know, everyone just being out there. Does that pitch work to them? Is there still pushback because it's a car or looks like a car?
It's
got
four
tires?
So the last time David Zipper is like one of the big, you know, sort of urbanist AV critics, and like a very smart guy. I have a ton of respect for him, and I always have really interesting conversations. I always learn something from him when we talk. But the last time he was on my podcast, you know, I tried to bring this up. We were talking about other things. We didn't have time to like flesh it through. And like, I think on a conceptual level, this isn't hard to understand that AVs and cars are different. By the way, one of the things, you know, I did a consulting contract for AVSI, which is sort of a big like drone. They mostly do drones, not so much AV. They do some AV stuff. But I kind of pitched them, like this whole contract was sort of how to sort of deal with some of these educational problems. And the whole thing was, stop calling them self-driving vehicles cars. Maybe you don't stop calling them vehicles. Call them robo-taxis, robo-trucks, because they're robots. They're not car, like a car. From a consumer perspective, there's two attributes to a car. And one is you own it. And two is that it goes anywhere you want to go. It's essentially what you call level five. If it were automated, it would have to be level five. And the technology doesn't support that. So let's stop making the category error, right? Like it's hard to explain the technology to people, but it's easy to say this is a car and this isn't a car, right? And there are ways that the technologies that make up driving automation tech, you know, can improve car safety too. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit before we have to go. But that is a separate conversation from AVs, because fundamentally how you interact with them, how they function on an economic level, it's fundamentally different than cars. And unfortunately, like the AV industry, I think unfortunately the incentives are such, I think their investors want to think that like long-term, this is going to be just like cars that drive themselves. And they don't want to tell their investors that they're wrong about that, because maybe down the road they won't be. Maybe down the road, like the technology will mature enough, and we will have this nightmare scenario that I think the urbanists are rightly worried about, which is that car, you know, self-driving cars as we know them now are just going to drive themselves, and they're going to get rid of the friction that prevents us from living in our cars, basically, because they'll be driving themselves. That nightmare scenario is possible. And if you sit on your hands and you don't engage constructively, my argument is, if you don't engage constructively with the robotaxis and these other approaches and also like Nuro with their robotic delivery stuff, like these are fundamentally not cars. And I think that it's so important, if we don't understand that and embrace that, then there is the risk that just sort of nothing happens, that we fight to a stalemate for 20 years even potentially, and that at that point maybe, you know, this technology gets to the point where what Elon Musk has been selling for the past like 7 years actually can become real.
Right. Okay. I think that all makes sense. And yes, so if you're, let's say Ed's in charge, you know, we put you in charge. Like, what's your message to, you know, either urban areas or suburban, ex-urban areas? Like, what would you do? How quickly would you roll out L4? And then how quickly would you move to putting as much of this L4 technology in private cars to keep them as, in my opinion, just as safe as possible from killing the people in the cars or the people around the cars? Like, how fast would you move? What would your timeline look like?
Yeah, so again, it's important to kind of separate driving automation tech into its different parts, right? And so I think with the robotaxis, you know, I think there's been, and again, you know, one of the fears is that we've had all this hype that this technology is like right around the corner and it's going to be this massive, you know, iPhone, like it's going to be like the iPhone only for your car kind of change thing. And like, clearly, you know, we're farther away from the tech being that broadly implemented. Like, it's not, you know, it's not going to be something where you solve self-driving and then it just scales everywhere. Fundamentally, you're actually, when you automate a task, you have to automate it. If you can automate the same task in two different domains and those domains are different, then actually the work, the software, and even sometimes the hardware it takes to automate them, it has to be different. So L4 is not going to just scale overnight. And so it's going to be a piece by piece thing. It's going to be, so I do.
Well, wait, just on that, yeah. Like, would you say L4 is at the iPhone moment? Like, again, that's what my feeling was when I rode in the Waymo. I thought, man, this is better than I thought in San Francisco. Like, I was like, I'm around technology all the time, and I'm an optimist and everything, but I was definitely like, wow, if everyone rode in these and they were around more, like, this would be, you know, do you feel like it's at that moment, or do you think there's just a lot more kinks that need to be worked out?
Yeah, so we tend to think of technology when it's mature as scaling sort of universally. Like, it's something that you can just get everywhere. And with a phone, like, as long as there's a cell phone tower, like, it's going to work. That's all it takes, literally. With an AV, you know, there is no one, you know, model of the world. Because AVs, basically, you build a model of the world that essentially allows it to reason and navigate, you know, through the section of the world that's in. That model has to match the part of the world that it's in. And so when you go to a new city, you do have to rebuild and rejigger that model. And so I do think, though, that Waymo proved, they went to Phoenix. Everyone thought they would be down there on easy mode and like would never be able to get out of that. They actually went into San Francisco, which is very different than Phoenix, and very much more difficult. So and they're doing a good job of performing there, like, given that they haven't been there for 5 years, like Cruise and Zooks and stuff, right? So clearly this technology can scale. And yes, like, if you've driven in San Francisco, that's the other thing. People just say this technology is fake or it's not real or it's not ready or whatever. Like, you drive in San Francisco. Like, if you can spend a day driving all over San Francisco and not screw up once yourself and not see other humans screw up, like, go ahead, criticize the L4 companies. But like, it's just not reasonable or fair. Like, having driven in San Francisco and hated every moment of it, like, it is mind-blowing to see that. But I think it's also really important to admit that this is also not a technology that is going to just solve all of our road safety problems for us. It's just not going to scale fast enough. It's too expensive and it's too slow. And as it's just going to take time. Maybe at some point down the future, you know, that's a world where mostly AVs and we have dramatically reduced. But in the meantime, like, we can't just wait forever for robotaxis to be everywhere. And cars are, you know, we're moving the wrong way with safety. And particularly with vulnerable road users. So what I would do to take the technology that we have now to take a big bite out of it, there's a number of things you can do. Like, in terms of occupant safety, you know, I would say like seatbelt interlock is the number one thing. Can't start a car unless your seatbelt's not. Like, that would be the easiest thing in the world to do. We tried it in the 80s. That didn't work because the technology wasn't right. Nowadays, it would be trivial to do. It would cost nothing. It's absurd that we don't do it. It kind of shows how unserious we are about, but that's occupant. For vulnerable road users, which again, I think is, if you're serious from a data-driven perspective about road safety and cars, you know, what you want to target is vulnerable road user deaths, particularly in low light conditions. And so what I would do, the probably the lowest lying fruit, lowest hanging fruit from a technology perspective, is you take the system that we know drives improve safety outcomes. There's no like autopilot. None of these level two systems actually improve safety that we can tell from the data yet. What does is called automated emergency braking, which you may not even know if your car has it because you don't know until you're almost in a crash. And that's when it sees something coming in front of you that you don't want to hit and it just hits the brakes for you. That, you know, talking about 40% reductions in frontal crashes. I mean, that's huge. So we know that works, but we know it doesn't work with pedestrians because it uses mostly radar, which is not great, you know, and like cheap radar. So we know it doesn't work for pedestrians. We especially know it doesn't work great at, a lot of them use cameras too. Some of them use like radar, but some of them use cameras. And both of them especially at the price points that they're at, they just don't work in those places where we're seeing the numbers going the wrong way. So what I would do is I would take AEB and just say, you know, we, in order to get an NCAP 5-star rating, you know, it has to perform, you have to pass a test with pedestrian crash test dummies in low light conditions. And what that would effectively do is it would force automakers to put higher quality sensors. And you know, I don't think from the government perspective, you have to say what kind. It could be LiDAR can you know, drive this kind of performance improvement, maybe some kind of imaging radar, certainly thermal imaging. And so there's a number of options. So you have competition among the sensor suppliers about which is going to serve this cheapest and most effectively, right? But the important thing is you make a test that actually, you know, values the lives of people outside the vehicle in the conditions where they're being hurt. Because then, because again, you, we know AEB works. If we improve the sensor that that feeds into that, instead of just a cheap camera, we have like, you know, a nice, like a LiDAR system or something like that, we can see really dramatic improvements. And again, in the kinds of places where the deaths are really going the wrong way. And the best part is, you know, we can do all the stuff that the other stuff that urbanists want to do too. This does not mean, right? Like, this does not take any government money per se to have a higher test standard.
Yep.
It doesn't.
On that, so basically interlocking seatbelts and detections and seatbelts on ignition and then AAB, like, is there anything moving through, any bills being proposed around that from a regulatory standpoint today?
No.
On either of those?
No, unfortunately, so regulators, you know, don't have a lot of incentive to independently create higher standards. They usually have to be pushed from the legislative side. And my understanding is the last successful push on the legislative side was actually to put a backup cameras in place. And so now every car has a backup camera. That's a mandate. That's not just saying a higher test standard. That's actually saying you are required to put this hardware in your car, right? And we did that based on, I don't know, I don't have the statistics in front of me, very tragic circumstances, people basically backing over their children.
Crazy. Yeah, it was like
But it's like 3 or 4 deaths a year, which again, it's not that those aren't tragic deaths, and it's not that we shouldn't try to replace them, but the number of VRU deaths is much, much higher, and we're not doing anything to address that.
I believe the last data I saw was 70% of all deaths were front end collision, where the front end is hitting something, hitting a person, hitting another car. So your point on AAB there in low light is a very good one, where you could make a, I'll pull up the chart on the collision data, but like, that would take a big chunk if potentially you could make it so the front end of the car doesn't hit something else.
It basically
thousands of people's lives.
Makes it almost impossible. And you see Luminar, LiDAR companies, does some really cool demos that you can find on like YouTube, where they take a Tesla AEB and show how insufficient the camera-based system is. And it's terrifying being in one of those vehicles. It hits this like child-shaped dummy and the parts go flying and it's like, ugh. And then they do the same thing with their LiDAR-based AEB. And it just, the speed at which it reacts and the speed with which it's able to brake is just the reaction time and everything is so much faster. And they're doing tests where like there's like a vehicle occluding and the kid comes out from behind the vehicle and they're still able to see it in just this tiny amounts of space. It's crazy.
So what do you
me.
Think? Yeah. Well, clearly you had the regulations where that made the backup cameras mandatory.
Yeah.
Now there's technology from these companies where clearly if it was installed would save thousands of lives, and again, think about it globally, many more. Like, what is the where do you think the push is going to come from? Is it going to come because it's going to get so cheap? Is it going to come from the, you know, people saying it seems like we tolerate 40,000 deaths a year, like just is what it is. Where do you think that push is going to come from? Would it be just the cost curve, and then the market is like, you know, you could market in a way where it's like, yeah, you'll never hit anyone again, like, or you know,
I think
like,
there's a lot of, yeah, I think there's a lot of pieces that have to that kind of play into it. I think marketing, on the marketing level, you know, automakers do need to realize that, like, yes, people want to protect the people that are in their vehicles, but like, nobody wants to kill someone driving home, you know, because they're not paying attention. I think that it's a little bit of a third rail in automotive marketing. I think it's very hard for them to be like, hey, you know, you might kill someone when you're out driving. But like, so that's a super important message for people to hear, because you literally, it's your best chance of killing someone is when you're behind the wheel, and especially if you're not paying. So I think there's a marketing side. I do think that the regulatory side though is really justified, because I think, you know, one of the reasons that urbanists are so angry is that they don't see anyone in government, you know, standing up for their safety. every time we increase safety standards, which by the way, we almost never do in the automotive world, it's always for occupants, right? So I think it is important to signal that, like, hey, you know, the other people on the road, like, their lives are valuable. And by the way, too, you know, it's very easily justified by the fact that cars are getting bigger, vehicles are getting bigger, vehicles are getting heavier, and vehicles are getting much harder to see out of. These are all, we're making these problems worse, which is why the statistics are getting worse as well. So, and then the final piece, I think, on the regulatory side, not only would like instituting the, you know, this higher test standard on the regulatory side, not only would it improve actual safety outcomes, like just as a direct first order effect, but as a second order effect too, this is actually how you bend the cost curve on technologies like LiDAR, like thermal, right? Is that you, and again, like traditionally you mandate it. I'd be open for that too. If we want to mandate, you know, but I think it is, I think the technology is unsettled enough. We should structure this as a way for different sensor modalities and different companies to be able to compete again on price and performance, so that we get the best outcome, you know, into vehicles. But yeah, like, it, you know, by getting them in there, right, by creating incentives for automakers to put these sensors into not AVs, because AVs are built in tiny quantities. And so AVs are not bending the cost curve on any of these technologies yet. We have to put them into production vehicles where all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of units a year for one model, right, with a major automaker. That is how you bend the cost curve. Now you're talking about cheap LiDAR, cheap radar, all of these sensors becoming much, much, much cheaper, at least the ones that are winning out this competition. Now, all of a sudden, you have all kinds of opportunities to put them in all kinds of, maybe even put them in the infrastructure, put them in all kinds of different things that will then drive road safety. Like cheap LiDAR has countless applications for making it, but we haven't been able to bend the cost curve. So I think from a regulatory and like a, not just a auto safety regulation, but from a policy perspective, when you think about, you know, just competitiveness in technology, like there is a real incentive for our industry, you know, the U.S. auto industry, to be the one that starts to bend the cost curve on this technology. Because if we know other countries will, they'll build up the supply chains and we'll be right where we are with batteries, you know?
Yep. Okay. I like that. And I think that's a great challenge to everyone out there is like, we've, you know, this bending this cost curve will save, you know, countless lives, countless American lives. And then of course, globally, you know, I think it's 1.3 million people we lose a year to road violence globally. So yeah, there is a very real opportunity here. Okay, Ed, last question, you know, for the audience, again, we talked a lot about the urbanists who I think are anti this, but I think we can overcome that. To the micromobility audience, people that ride, you know, like small vehicles, scooters, e-bikes, one wheels, electric dirt bikes, motorcycles, you know, is what we're seeing in San Francisco, and soon I should mention rolling out, it sounds like in quite a few American cities, both Waymo and Cruise expanding. When they see an L4 vehicle, is this friend or foe?
Yeah, I think it is really important. And again, like, I don't want to tell people how they should relate to this, right? Like, if you want to not like it, that's fine. Like, I think it's important when you are trying to change people's minds about things or educate them or help them understand something that, like, you just recognize when people are just digging in their heels and they just don't like it, like, fine, like, whatever. If you just don't like it, you just don't like it. But yeah, I do think it's super important to understand that these are not cars. And I know that's hard. And I know that, especially, you know, coming from someone like me who used to work for the AV, you know, education nonprofit, like, it sounds like you're being propagandized, but I urge you, just look into it, like open your mind, you know, and just look into the difference between an L4 vehicle and, you know, a self-driving car. Like, these basic, like, a lot of the problems that people have in understanding this technology. And by the way, people who are pro this technology misunderstand a lot too. Like, you don't, it's not just the people who don't like it that misunderstand it. And so I think it's just really important. Like, I think, like, in a lot of things, like in politics and a lot of things, it's just so easy to define your views based on what you don't like, right? Like, kind of posing something and kind of to engage in this, sort of demagogic kind of, you know, opinion level. And I think, again, it's fine to have opinions, but I think this technology is super important. It's much farther along than I think people realize, but it's also going to take more time to be fully integrated in our society. Like, in some ways, the tech is easy compared to you know, things like insurance and regulation and law enforcement and first responders and like all of these things. And so, so I think like, you know, people should see AVs less as this imminent threat. Like, I think they see it as Facebook or these other technologies that just come and they didn't have a choice in. They didn't have any say in it. It just was there one day and you can never go back. AVs are not going to be like that. We have a window here where we are, where the technology continues to refine, but mostly the challenge is we are figuring out how to integrate this into our society. And I think to do that, we have to, the first thing you have to understand is that these are not cars. These are different than cars. And it's really important to understand why. And I think once you're able to do that, then you're able to like understand it on its own terms and work through the good things and the bad things from your perspective, which are always going to be your thing, right? But like, you can actually do that. You're not just getting caught up in this sort of, you know, culture war-ish kind of, you know, sentiment. You're actually, you know, making these decisions on your own. And I think that's what we want to see is I think, right, it's not about pushing this technology through or opposing this technology. For me, at least, educating people about this technology is about helping them just make the decisions about what it is. And I think the most important thing that you can understand about this stuff is that it's not just cars. And if you treat them as just L4 vehicles, as these are just cars that drive themselves, you will misunderstand them. And frankly, I think you will miss an opportunity to help shape this technology into something that is well aligned with the urbanist values. And then if this opportunity is not taken, the risk is that you get the very thing that you were afraid of, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that you get the sort of car monopoly hell forever that you're afraid of. And so I would say getting past that fear and engaging with the technology and embracing the L4 opportunity, which, you know, again, like if you really think about this technology, it's actually much more aligned to things like transit than it is with public, with private car ownership as we know it, right? So like my pitch is embrace this opportunity. It won't be here forever. And it's a huge opportunity to, again, completely rethink, you know, what our cities are going to look like in the future in a way that actually brings, you know, tech people and mobility people and cyclists and pedestrians and everyone together to have one conversation. So that's what I want to see.
That's great. And let's leave it there. I think to summarize, it's a nuanced world. It's a nuanced challenge, but it's one that we can all mold and build together. And on that, we'll have Ed at Micromobility America here in the San Francisco Bay Area, right in ground zero of this all, on October 19th and 20th, to hopefully host some of these conversations with us, with hopefully some of the best companies in this space. So Ed, thank you for joining today, and looking forward to seeing you in about 2 months to, you know, who knows what progress we'll be at there, where we'll be in the progress chain when we get to San Francisco in a couple months, but it should be fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't wait. Yeah, I'll see you there.
Cool. See you later.